This is a production of Cornell University.
I want to thank you all for coming to the English Department's annual Gottschalk Lecture. The Gottschalk Memorial Lecture was established in memory of Paul Gottschalk, professor of English at Cornell, a scholar of British Renaissance literature who died in 1977 at the age of 38. The Gottschalk Lecture is a reliable highlight of the year on the English Department lecture schedule. In the time I've been here, it's brought to campus many of the outstanding people in Renaissance studies and not in Renaissance studies alone. Today is, of course, no exception. This is, in fact, the second time I've had the pleasure of introducing a distinguished scholar of Renaissance literature on my birthday. Since, however, you've come to see and hear Richard Halpern rather than me, I will try to keep my remarks brief. One way of doing so is to do something that I'm told someone in my structural position actually once did. He got up and said, "So-and-so is going to speak now," and just sat down. This angered a member of the audience who shouted, "Introduce the speaker," to which the introducer replied, "He needs no introduction." Richard Halpern needs no introduction. But I lack the chutzpah to go that route. Richard has taught at Yale, Colorado, Berkeley, and Johns Hopkins, where he is currently Sir William Osler Professor of English. He has served on various important editorial boards, including those for Representations and right now ELH, and has been the recipient of a number of grants and awards, most recently a Guggenheim Fellowship last year. More immediately relevant for all of us are his four books, The Poetics of Primitive Accumulation, English Renaissance Culture and the Genealogy of Capital, 1991, Cornell University Press, Shakespeare Among the Moderns, 1997, also Cornell, Shakespeare's Perfume, Sodomy and Sublimity in Shakespeare Wilde, Freud and Lacan, 2002, from some other press, and the book that followed ineluctably from these three, Norman Rockwell, The Underside of Innocence, 2006. Richard's work is routinely characterized by impressive learning, theoretical sophistication, and most important, original and persuasive claims. Also something else, which if I describe it as stylistic elegance, will misleadingly evoke the bygone belletristic era of the man of letters, which is actually not at all what I mean. So let me instead have recourse to a fully up-to-date theoretical vocabulary and say instead that Richard is a fun read. Discussing Marx's critique of Adam Smith's account of primitive accumulation, he comments, "The problem is that Smith's actual views are almost entirely contrary to those of which Marx accuses him. What could be gained by misattributing them to Smith, especially when this error would be obvious? Without pretending to pluck out the heart of this mystery, I may nevertheless observe that the rhetoric of Capital thus reenacts or performs the myth of primitive accumulation itself, in that Adam Smith, like the poor, comes to bear a moral burden that is not rightfully his. Marx's play on the name of Adam Smith is then rich, indeed, just as theological myth makes Adam the author of all of human sinfulness, so Marx's myth makes Adam Smith the source of all the sins of political economy." It's the first quote. One sees the same tendency more briefly exemplified in Shakespeare Among the Moderns, where a chapter subheading introduces a discussion of the Merchant of Venice as follows: "Which is the critic and which the Jew?" In the same vein, a celebrated essay in Marx's Shakespeare, 2001, entitled An Impure History of Ghosts, Derrida, Marx, Shakespeare, includes among its subtitles An Enema of the People, Derrida's Purge, and Skulduggery, or The Phrenology of Spirit. In a slightly different vein, the Rockwell book begins in this fashion. On October 10, 1980, Mark David Chapman sold his beloved lithograph of Norman Rockwell's triple self-portrait to a Hawaiian public relations man for $7,500. Chapman, who was strapped for cash, used the proceeds to quit his job, purchase a .38 revolver, buy airfare to New York, and book a room at the Waldorf Astoria. From this base of operations, he would stalk John Lennon at the Dakota and finally, in December, take his life. I find it suggested that one icon of innocence was used to fund the assassination of another," unquote. And a little later, I put the word adults in scare quotes because one so rarely meets a real adult nowadays. Most people one encounters are rather overgrown children, fully ensconced in a manufactured innocence real children would have no difficulty seeing through. End quote. You can see from the titles of the books and from these excerpts that Richard has moved from Renaissance studies as informed by modern thought to a more systematic account of the interplay of Renaissance and modern culture in which each illuminates the other. You may also be able to detect an ongoing engagement with Hamlet, most recently in his article Eclipse of Action, Hamlet and the Political Economy of Playing, Shakespeare Quarterly 2008. This makes him, of course, a particularly appropriate Gottschalk lecturer, given that Paul Gottschalk was the author of the book The Meanings of Hamlet, 1972. Richard is currently working on a book of his own about tragedy and political economy. His lecture today, which may well be heading into that book, is entitled The Same Old Grind, Milton Samson as Subtragic Hero. Please join me in welcoming Richard Halpern.
Thank you, Walter, for that lovely introduction. You are a hard act to follow. I don't know what I'll be able to do here. I just want to say how happy I am to be here today and how honored I am to have been asked to give the Gottschalk lecture this year. You are right, this talk does come from my ongoing project on tragic drama and political economy. Briefly, what I argue there is that the advent of political economy, classical political economy, which I take to start with Adam Smith, poses a fundamental challenge to tragedy and tragic drama. If tragedy is, as Aristotle claims, the imitation of an action, what happens when political economy dethrones action, understood in an ethical or political sense, in the name of production? What happens if what you make rather than what you do determines the difference between human prosperity and happiness on the one hand and wretchedness and misery on the other? How does tragedy cope with a circumstance in which what had been the very substance of it, human action, is suddenly demoted? Now this is a dilemma that would obviously most directly afflict modern drama, but I think that the advent of political economy also casts a retrospective light on certain tensions that had inhabited drama from the very beginning, and not only drama, but philosophical discussions of drama since the ancient Greeks. So this is kind of an Aeschylus through Beckett sort of book, but it does focus largely on the early modern period for reasons I can talk about later. So that's by way of introduction. It's a longish talk, so I don't want to precede it with too much. So The Same Old Grind, Milton Samson as Subtragic Hero. This thing is like, it's attacking me. I'm going to move over a little bit. There we go. That's good. In Samson or Holy Revenge, a Dutch trauerspiel published in 1660, the Hebrew chorus complains at one point, "Oh, what a shame to trample on a conquered hero thus, to make him toil. 'Tis unjust and past reason." Making Samson labor at the mill violates the ethical norms for treating a conquered warrior of his stature, but it also violates the literary norms for treating the protagonist of a tragic drama. Tragic heroes traditionally love or kill, suffer and die. At the outer limits, they can even, as in the case of Aeschylus's Prometheus, be clapped in chains. But they do not, almost by definition, work, much less engage in the kind of repetitive, sweaty, and mindless toil engaged in by the captured Samson. By depicting a hero who labors at the mill, Joost van den Vondel, the author of this trauerspiel, thus repeats in an aesthetic dimension the crime of Samson's Philistine captors. Nor is this doubling accidental. The Philistine prince and princess in van den Vondel's play engage in a long conversation about the social and religious virtues of theater, and their plans for Samson involve not merely displaying his strength for a Philistine audience, but having him play himself in an allegorical mask about his seduction and capture by Delilah. That the Philistines are playwrights reminds us that the playwright is also a metaphorical Philistine, entrapping the Hebrew hero within a Gentile literary form, and moreover, subjecting him to a laborious degradation not undergone by other tragic heroes. My point in invoking van den Vondel, however, is not to explore the byways of authorial sadism. It's rather to point out that Samson is not just one tragic hero among others. He's a hero who descends to levels of human experience not undergone by any classical predecessors, and as such, he exerts a reciprocally transformative effect on tragic drama itself. The Samson story was a popular theme for early modern playwrights. Over 40 Samson plays were composed in Latin and vernacular languages during the 16th and 17th centuries. Among these, Milton's Samson Agonistes exhibits a particularly subtle and searching awareness of what it means to inject a laboring hero into the form of classical tragedy. The interest of Samson is not just that he begins as, quote, a person separate to God, designed for great exploits, end quote, and ends up eyeless at Gaza at the mill with slaves. More than a reversal of fortune is involved. Why, Samson asks in his opening soliloquy, was he set apart if his fate is, quote, to grind in brazen fetters under task with his heaven-gifted strength, O glorious strength, put to the labor of a beast, debased lower than bondslave, end quote. It's not just that Samson once acted and now toils, rather the bodily strength that enabled heroic deeds, in a sense the very physical substance of heroic action itself, has now been converted into labor power, and alienated labor power at that, enriching the enemies of his people. If we take Samson's grammar seriously, it is not he but his strength that has been debased, not he but his strength, which can now be apostrophized as if it were an independent agent that has been put to bestial toil. But this rechanneling of heroic force into labor power and the resulting substitution of productive activity for the heroic act presents in a condensed and catastrophic form the very transition which my book is attempting to trace. In this respect, Samson Agonistes is uniquely emblematic of the predicament of modern drama, as I understand it. To be fair, we never actually see Milton Samson labor, just as we never directly see him die. Samson Agonistes takes place on a holiday devoted to the god Dagon. The space for its tragic action is cleared by temporarily releasing Samson from his daily round of milling. Moreover, Milton does not invoke the physical effects of this labor as vividly as does Vandenvondel, who depicts his hero as dusty with flour and as giving off an unbearable stench. For Milton, Samson's toil remains largely in the background. Indeed, Samson's redemption or regeneration, if such it is, might well be described not only as his escape from a state of spiritual despair to become once again God's favorite, but also as an escape from labor to the higher realm of tragic action. Pulling down the Philistine temple is Samson's answer to his enforced toil, a return, as it were, from the improper activity of work to his proper activity of killing. If a tragic hero has anything to do with heavy stones, they should be used not to crush grain, but to crush the heads of his enemies. And yet, the notion of Samson's spiritual regeneration has been subjected to a good deal of critical skepticism in recent decades, and I shall likewise argue here that his tragic act does not really separate itself from the realm of labor either. Samson's milling, though kept in the background, fundamentally twists the norms of tragic drama. Samson may leave the mill, but the mill, for its part, won't let go of Samson. And I'll skip some stuff here. We might begin to gauge Samson's condition by comparing it with that of Shakespeare's King Lear, another noble reduced to wretched circumstances. Lear finds himself at a limit state. Exposed on the stormy heath, bereft of shelter, food, and reason, he comes face to face with unaccommodated man, the degree zero of the human condition, a poor, bare, forked animal. By contrast, Samson is fed, housed, and clothed by his captors, though in a shabby fashion. He's overworked, but not to an unendurable pitch. His physical discomfort does not match that of Philoctetes in Sophocles' play, nor do his chains constrain him to the degree that Prometheus's do in Aeschylus. Samson's dilemma, we might say, is precisely his inability to reach such a limit state. His suspension at a debased but supportable level of existence that denies even his suffering a genuinely tragic grandeur. Debasement, more than physical pain, is Samson's punishment. The Philistines aim more at the reduction of his status than at causing excruciating physical pain. Putting Samson to work at the mill prevents him from achieving the status of triumphant or tragic hero. As Samson reveals, moreover, economic motives are at play. Quote, Much more affliction than already felt they cannot well impose, nor I sustain, if they intend advantage of my labors, the work of many hands, which earns my keeping with no small profit daily to my owners. It's tempting to offer this passage as a privileged point of revelation in the play, a sudden tearing away of the veil to expose the hidden production of surplus value as the startling economic secret behind Samson's confinement. And yet Samson offers alternative explanations for his labor, sometimes describing it as a punishment imposed by God, at other times depicting it as at least somewhat voluntarily undertaken, a way for him to maintain self-respect by earning his keep. Samson's milling has in any case an exhibition value for the Philistines as well as an economic one, though we may want to regard this as simply a different kind of surplus extracted from his labors, this time as performance rather than production. The point is that Samson's milling exhibits a frightening logical efficiency. Since labor power is both the debased thing into which his heroic strength is converted and a motive to maintain him indefinitely in this state of perpetual drudgery. Recent criticism, which has focused on the role of Christian typology in Milton's play, has paid much less attention to the conspicuous parallels between Samson and the protagonist of Aeschylus's play, Prometheus Bound. Both Samson and Prometheus spend their respective plays in chains. Both therefore remain stationary and are addressed by various visitors, some friendly, some not. Both call on the sun. Both are undone by secrets, Samson for revealing his and Prometheus for refusing to reveal his. And both end their respective plays overwhelmed by violent force, the difference being that Prometheus, unlike Samson, cannot die. In addition, the Hebrew chorus at one point explicitly compares Samson to another of Prometheus's fellow Titans, Atlas. These Promethean references interact complexly with the Christian typologies of Milton's play, in that the division between Titanic and Olympian eras redoubles that between Old and New Testament in the Christian typological scheme. In the case of Prometheus, moreover, these two temporal eras have additional significance that redounds upon the Samson story. Aeschylus's hero brings mankind not only fire, but the various arts or technae that make human life worth living. Carpentry, masonry, metallurgy, and so forth. In Plato's Protagoras, these are classed as arts of Hephaestus, as well as medicine, literacy, and prophecy, classed by Plato as arts of Athena. The one thing that Prometheus cannot give man in Plato's version is the civic art, or politikos techne, that only Zeus can furnish. Prometheus's mechanical arts provide physical comfort, but only Zeus allows men to organize themselves into the higher life of the city. In a kind of ironic contrapasso, Prometheus is chained up using the same arts of Hephaestus he taught to mankind. Associating Samson with Prometheus and Atlas therefore strengthens his connection with manual crafts and labor. The Promethean elements in Samson resonate complexly with the Hebrew ones. As an Israelite, Samson predates the Christian era of grace, and as a Titan, he predates the Olympian era of the political. As Hebrew as well, he would be associated with carnal Israel, the realm of the flesh as opposed to spirit. And as Prometheus, he would likewise be associated with those arts that promote mere life, that of the body, as opposed to civic existence. The grain produced by Samson's work at the mill does sustain the flesh, thereby reinforcing both Hebrew and Greek typologies. But Samson's Promethean echoes do not merely situate him within the realm of mere life, they point to his entrapment by it. In Aeschylus's play, Zeus cannot kill Prometheus, in part because the Titan is immortal, but also because Zeus can't afford to lose the possibility of learning his secret. He therefore subjects his foe to the prospect of endless imprisonment, chained to a remote mountaintop so that it can neither move nor die. Alive, but isolated and deprived of any social context, Prometheus is forced to live the sub-political existence he provided for mankind, and to do so endlessly. His kinsman Atlas is likewise ceaselessly constrained, alone, and subjected to a laborious task he can never finish. Milton Samson finds himself in a Promethean predicament, at once punished and sustained by enemies who cannot afford to kill or even severely harm him because of the profit he produces. Sequestered from the fields of the divine and of the political, Samson is deprived of the possibility of action and condemned to a seemingly interminable state of mere life. The mill wheel, whose circular turning knows neither beginning nor end, becomes therefore an emblem of Samson's predicament, which in some respects is even worse than that of Prometheus. Because the Titan could end his suffering in a moment by agreeing to Zeus's demands, his refusal to do so reinvests even his powerlessness with heroic stature. Unable to move, he is paradoxically still able to act, if only in a negative fashion, by maintaining his willful defiance of what he regards as tyrannical authority. Samson lacks even this baleful option. Not only is he not defying his foes, he is, through his productive activity, enriching them on a daily basis, as both Manoah and the chorus are only too happy to remind him. Even his attempts to assume moral responsibility for his predicament have struck critics as both masochistic and megalomaniacal. Unlike his titanic predecessor, Samson lacks all possibilities for meaningful action. By play's end, Samson seems to break out of this state of suspension to achieve one final violent and cataclysmic act. And yet it's unclear whether Samson's pulling down of the temple is an escape from his productive activity or merely a perverse extension of it. Samson's mill has already demonstrated a capacity to extend its dominion beyond the merely literal, as when the chorus observes to Samson that, quote, "This idol's day hath been to thee no day of rest, laboring thy mind more than the working day, thy hands," end quote. Laboring thy mind is less a periphrasis for thinking than it is a name for a different kind of mental activity, what happens instead of thought when the mind's motions are captured by those of the mill. Having dominated Samson's body, his res extensa, the mill proceeds to colonize his res cogitans as well. We might be justified in overlooking the chorus's figuration of thinking as milling if it did not return, less directly but still unmistakably, in the final moments before Samson's cataclysmic act. Quote, "With head a while inclined, and eyes fast fixed, he stood, as one who prayed, or some great matter in his mind revolved." The great matter that Samson revolves in his mind punningly invokes the enormous millstone he revolved in the prison house. It may be that the echo is meant to signal how Samson's final act transcends and negates his productive activity, but it may also reduce his final act to a mere continuation of it. In any case, the pun rings oddly and somewhat distastefully in context. That Samson's pulling down of the temple can be seen as just more milling is an idea developed explicitly by Vandenfundel. I'll quote from his Samson. "My strength that in its weakness ground their corn, if but once more it may repeat its power, shall grind a grist of skulls and human bones, and so regard the past as richly paid for." Here, grinding the skulls of his enemies is both a repetition and a negation of his earlier activity, figuratively payback. Milton is far more elusive and less direct than Vandenfundel, but his pun makes Samson's final act into an unmistakable repetition of his earlier activity, and thus raises the question of whether there's any possible escape from the mill. Samson grinds himself along with his foes under the massive stones of the temple, and if this puts an end to his milling, it does so only by converting him from the grinder into the ground. There's an old German saying, when the mill has no more corn to grind, it grinds itself. Milton's version of this would seem to be, when the miller has no more corn to grind, he grinds himself. Milton's final act is not so much an escape from the mill as a merging with it, resulting in a mangled heap of stone, blood, and flesh. Some 17th century biblical commentators were dismayed by Samson's pulling down of the Philistine temple, a murderous act which struck them as the very opposite of Christ's self-sacrifice. Joseph Whitrike, a contemporary critic, present-day critic, notes how Milton's allusion to the play Christ's Suffering in the preface to Samson Agonistes draws attention to the enormous difference between the avenging Samson and the patient Christ, the one delivering his enemies and himself to death, and the other dying so that his enemies might be saved. Other modern critics of Milton's poem have likewise expressed doubt about whether there is anything redemptive about its violent climax. Some are troubled by the fact that the generous-minded Philistines ready to ransom Samson are killed along with the rest. Others by the sheer scale of the bloodbath. Others by the fact that all this violence does nothing to liberate the captive Israelites. And others still by the fact that Samson's rousing motions, which spur him on to the deed, may be mere bodily impulse rather than divine inspiration. These doubts have been both summed up and inflated by recent debates over whether Milton Samson is a religious terrorist. I have a lot to say on that topic, but not right here. The question here is how understanding his act as an extension of Samson's milling activity can either add to or clarify the swarm of doubts that already hover about it. My answer would be not by adding any new layers of significance to it. On the contrary, the essence of Samson's milling is precisely its meaninglessness, its futile circularity. Milling produces grain, not meaning. It's true that milling has picked up various forms of figurative significance through rabbinical and Christian commentary. For the rabbis, milling could be a metaphor for the sexual act, and for both Talmudic and Christian interpreters, milling could be a figure for scriptural interpretation itself. While I wouldn't want to deny that the sexual overtones of milling play a role in Samson's pulling down of the temple, especially given the imagery of childbirth that also occurs there, I think that the brute, meaningless materiality of the process is foremost. The pun that reduces great matter from an exalted topic of thought to a large stone is emblematic of the way in which Samson's milling drains significance from his final act, reducing it to what John Guillory has called a labor of destruction. Other critics have noted the images of circularity that attend the poem's end. Of the final simile comparing Samson to the phoenix, for instance, Joseph Whitreich remarks that the image of the phoenix, quote, may be of history rolling back into its former self. Even Marianne Rudzinowicz, on the whole an optimistic and affirmative reader of Samson Agonistes, observes that, quote, history moves in circles like the Philistine mill. Here we may note another final figurative meaning that attaches to the mill, that of apocalypse. This one, at least, is surely invoked by Samson's pulling down of the temple, but only to be disappointed, since Samson's bloodbath not only fails to end history, it does not advance it an inch. Neglecting to seize the moment, the Israelites remain justifiably in bondage in the wake of the tragedy visited upon their Philistine enemies. Indeed, if there is a tragedy to be found in Samson Agonistes, a good case could be made for viewing the Philistines and not Samson or the Israelites as the protagonists of it. A circular history, that is, history captured by Samson's mill, is no history at all. It's a temporal continuum deprived of the transformative or redemptive potential of the event. Another way to put this is to say that the temporality of tragedy cedes to that of Trauerspiel. What Walter Benjamin calls natural history results when time petrifies into an unchanging landscape. Accordingly, Samson himself retreats into the merely creaturely existence, the zone of mere life that is sustained indefinitely but prevented from acting. This is the ambiguous triumph of labor as Milton portrays it. Production is not, as it will later be for Karl Marx, the engine of historical development. It is rather an incessant round that colonizes and neutralizes the very possibility of the historical act, and with it, the possibility of the tragic as well. This next section is called Samson and the Failed Universal, and just to keep your flagging interest going, there will be some sex coming up. I have thus far been exploring the notion that labor drags Samson into an ambiguous zone beneath that of the tragic hero, but it could also be argued that the apparent meaninglessness or opacity that attaches to Samson's final action elevates him above the tragic. In Kierkegaard's Fear and Trembling, the figure known as the Knight of Faith transcends the tragic hero by means of an absolute relation to the absolute, as Kierkegaard puts it. Adopting an Hegelian perspective on classical tragedy, Kierkegaard argues that the tragic hero's action always has reference to the universal realm of ethics. His paradigm here is Agamemnon, who sacrifices his daughter Iphigenia for the Greek nation as a whole, thus undergoing personal loss for a higher good. The act of the tragic hero attempts to sacrifice or dissolve his individuality into the universal of ethics. By contrast, the Knight of Faith elevates his particularity above the general, entering into an individual relation with the absolute that is not mediated by the universal and thus appears absurd or meaningless. The paradigm here is Abraham, whose faith in offering to sacrifice his son simply cannot be made comprehensible to others. While the tragic hero speaks, because his language opens his actions onto the universal of language and meaning, the knight of faith remains silent because his unmediated faith cannot intelligibly be spoken. Now, it can be and has been argued that Milton Samson is just such a Kierkegaardian knight of faith. Or rather, the one critic who's taken up this theme maintains that we can't know whether Samson is one because his silence remains resolutely uninterpretable. In particular, the content of Samson's notorious rousing motions are unknown to us. Are they a silently delivered command from God, a falsely imagined command, or mere impulse from Samson's melancholic body? Certainly, Samson's final act does not accord with any obviously universalizable ethical mandate. If it has a meaning, its meaning is particular to him alone. The rest of us should not be pulling down temples and killing thousands, even if we could. What Kierkegaard says of Abraham, that though he rouses my admiration, he at the same time appalls me, could be said of Milton Samson as well. What interests me most about a Kierkegaardian reading of Milton's tragic play is not Samson's uncertain status as knight of faith, but rather his relation to Greek heroism, that is, to the universal. Exploring this issue will initially take us somewhat afield from the topic of labor, but will eventually allow return to it from a different angle. The problem of the universal in Samson Agonistes is encountered above all in the national or tribal divisions that constitute its world. While it's relatively easy to contrast Dagon as an idol or false god to Jehovah as the true one, things become much murkier in the realm of ethics. Both of his Philistine interlocutors, Dalilah and Harapha, are simultaneously foes and mirror images of Samson, which makes ethical adjudication between them frustratingly difficult. John Rumrich voices an increasingly widespread perspective in pointing out the ethical contradictions and inconsistencies that riddle Samson's encounter with Dalilah. And quoting Rumrich here, Samson blames Dalilah for violating the sanctity of marriage and betraying him, but he himself, quote, still watching to oppress Israel's oppressors, shows the way, betrothing Philistine women as a provocative tactic and so subordinating the proper ends of marriage to his political and religious agenda. Quote, I therefore urged the marriage on, he admits, that by occasion hence I might begin Israel's deliverance. End quote. Rumrich describes Samson and Delilah as, quote, opposite numbers, champions of their respective nations, more alike than different. That they both regard themselves as justified in defending their respective nations and gods, defending their respective nations and gods, even if this involves falsifying the bonds of marriage and betraying a spouse. And the play can offer no universal ethical framework that would decide between these conflicting tribal claims. Of course, this dilemma may be precisely Milton's point. Samson Agonistes takes place in an historical era prior to the advent of Christian universalism, the absence of which results in the dizzying mirror effects of Samson's encounters with Dalilah and Harapha. Lacking access to the universal, Samson's actions are not tragic in an Hegelian sense. Indeed, one critic regards Samson's predating of Christian universalism as precisely his Aristotelian hamartia, not an ethical flaw exactly, but an historically determined ignorance that fuels a blindly tribal form of aggression. Thinkers as different as Alain Badiou and Daniel Boyerin have identified the locus classicus of Christian universalism in the following verse from Paul's epistle to the Galatians. This is chapter 3, verse 28. There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither bond nor free, there is neither male nor female, for ye are all one in Jesus Christ. Samson is the point-by-point refutation of this verse. Not only is he a Jew, but as a Nazarite, God's covenant with Israel has been redoubled for him personally. Set apart even from the rest of his tribe, he is a kind of super-Jew. Not only is Samson male, he's possessed of an almost parodic hyper-masculinity, just as Dalilah embodies an explicitly Cleopatra-like hyper-femininity. Samson may be no more of a slave than his fellow grinders at the prison house, but his enslaved condition is felt all the more keenly because of his former religious and social eminence. Samson not only embodies all the forms of difference that the Christian covenant will supposedly cancel, according to the famous verse from Galatians, he drives these differences to their outer limit. In his person, he condenses and exaggerates every mode of particularity that Christian universalism will take it upon itself to dissolve. All that being said, Samson nevertheless exhibits certain obscure and primordial impulses toward the universal, but they either fall short of their aim or else achieve a universalism which is itself failed or tragic. These impulses center on two fundamental human activities, sex and labor. To start with the first of these, despite the hostile maneuvering on both sides, Samson's marriages with Philistine women do threaten to breach the barrier separating Jew and Gentile. Samson, of course, insists that he undertook these marriages only so, quote, that by occasion hence I might begin Israel's deliverance, and that he was, quote, still watching to oppress Israel's oppressors. Yet his father Manoah is openly skeptical of this explanation, and Samson himself later gives a somewhat different account, claiming that, quote, swollen with pride into the snare I fell of fair fallacious looks, venereal trains softened with pleasure and voluptuous life, end quote. His insistence that he married solely for political or military advantage clearly covers up, at least in part, for an uncontrollable libido that is attracted to forbidden Philistine women. Yet Samson's roving eye does indeed prompt him to love his enemies, if not quite in the sense that Jesus intended, and thus inclines to erase the line between Jew and Gentile. As Samson remarks to Haripha, quote, among the daughters of the Philistines I chose a wife which argued me no foe, and in your city held my nuptial feast. Something like Pauline universalism can be glimpsed here, but because it takes place under the aegis of Eros rather than of Agape, it allows hatred, jealousy, and aggression to mingle with love. Another way to put this is that Samson's sexual impulses produce a bodily and thus fallen counterpart to a Christian universalism that in St. Paul relies instead on spirit. For Paul, the body, and particularly the penis, is the site of difference, bearing the marks of both circumcision and sexual morphology. It is a site on which two of the three forms of difference mentioned in Galatians 3:28 come to bear. But ironically, Samson's penis, though carrying the mark of Jewish particularity, is a kind of divining rod that leads him against his will into foreign liaisons. A popular rabbinical interpretation of circumcision is precisely that it mortifies the sexual passions, but if this is so, the operation has spectacularly failed to take in Samson's case. Cutting his hair may temporarily sap his strength, but cutting his foreskin does not apparently dampen his sexual enthusiasms. But what would happen, to pose a counterfactual, if Samson's marriage with Delilah had worked out? What if they'd had a child together? Would this mixing of blood have begun to repair the rift between Hebrew and Philistine? Milton's play doesn't explore this possibility directly, but I think it does so in a kind of negative fashion. For in the play's catastrophic denouement, Samson achieves a deathly version of precisely this union with his enemies. He is described as, quote, tangled in the fold of dire necessity, whose law conjoined thee with thy slaughtered foes. Here the verb conjoined manages faintly to evoke marriage, even in the context of slaughter. Again, quote, Samson with these inmixed inevitably pulled down the same destruction on himself, end quote. Manoah urges the chorus, quote, let us go find the body where it lies, soaked in his enemy's blood, and from the stream with lavers pure and cleansing herbs wash off the clotted gore, end quote. Here the mixture of blood that would have taken place with Delilah alone has been extended to the entire Philistine nation, whose bloods now run together with Samson's. These mangled but therefore united bodies offer a grotesquely inverted image of the Pauline universality achievable through love. That images of both childbirth and abortion suffuse the play's catastrophe only underlines the fact that it substitutes for the child that Samson and Delilah never conceived. In place of that life born of love and the universality it might have foretold is one founded upon what Paul in the Epistle to the Romans calls this body of death. If Samson's erotic gestures towards the undoing of national or tribal divisions It does something similar with gender division. Once conjoined with Dalilah, the formerly virile Samson describes himself as, quote, effeminately vanquished and shorn like a tame wether, while Dalilah leaves their interview bearing a phallic, if merely metaphorical, quote, sting discovered in the end, till now concealed. Both enemies, formerly paragons of their respective sexes, end up in an ambiguously gendered state, neither fully male nor female, just as their marital union renders them neither fully Hebrew nor Philistine. And finally, Dalilah promises Samson that if he returns to her, quote, I to the Lord's will intercede, not doubting their favorable ear, that I may fetch thee from forth this loathsome prison house to abide with me where my redoubled love and care with nursing diligence to me glad office may ever tend about thee to old age, end quote. Released from prison but confined to a kind of pleasurable house arrest, Samson would find himself once again in an ambiguous state, neither fully enslaved nor fully free. His marriage to Dalilah thus gestures at undoing all three forms of particularity listed in Galatians 3:28. Yet this undoing is not so much a cancellation or sublation of antithetical states as their endless confusion. It is not as though Jew and Gentile, male and female, slave and free would cease to exist. It's simply that they would lose their sharp outlines in Samson's condition. What Samson can achieve is only the typological prefiguration of the universal, or rather, the universality of man's fallen state, not of the redeemed one. This is a universality that regresses to a time before the covenant with Israel, not one that overgoes it. It is the universality of wayward sexual desire, that is, of the shared but fallen condition of humanity. Sex, we may therefore say, is a failed universal. While desire is experienced by all, it cannot provide the encompassing ethical framework that both Hegel and Kierkegaard find requisite for tragedy. And by absorbing or contaminating love, it likewise forecloses the Christian universalism that would be announced by Paul. These issues have a literary as well as a thematic dimension. For what is Samson Agonistes if not an exogamous marriage of Hebraic content and Greek form? In this respect, the play invokes Renaissance humanist efforts to combine Greek and Hebrew studies into a unified field of knowledge. But Samson Agonistes does not accomplish, nor does it really attempt, a Pauline sublation of Hebrew and Greek strains. Rather, it remains a conspicuously, and I think an intentionally failed effort at synthesis, a bad marriage of incompatible elements that works out no more amicably than Samson's marriage with Dalilah. The play, in other words, registers the absence of a globalizing framework in its very form. If we now turn back to labor, we find that it, like sex, prefigures Christian universalism. For as with his sexual appetites, Samson's labor crosses the line separating tribes or nations. Just as he married a Philistine, Samson labors on behalf of the Philistines, and his countrymen exhibit similar forms of discomfort with both activities. When Samson objects to using his God-given strength to honor Dagon at the Philistine temple, the Hebrew chorus retorts, quote, yet with his strength thou servest the Philistines, idolatrous, uncircumcised, unclean. Manoah likewise asks his son, wilt thou then serve the Philistines with that gift, which was expressly given thee to annoy them? Manoah essentially accuses Samson of regifting here. He takes the strength given him by God and in turn gives it freely to the Philistines. Interestingly, both Manoah and the chorus seem to view Samson's labor for the Philistines as being at least to some degree voluntary. If Samson truly had no alternative, there would be little point in criticizing his exertions. An ambiguous space between enslavement and freedom, comparable to that which emerges in Samson's debate with Dalilah, therefore opens up here as well. Indeed, Samson goes so far as to defend his milling for the Philistines, describing it as, quote, labor honest and lawful to deserve my food of those who have me in their civil power, end quote. He does not, in other words, dispute the semi-voluntary quality of his labor, but instead explains and justifies his willingness to cooperate with his captors. Moreover, his explanation is itself somewhat suspect. Samson suggests that he works solely in order to earn his keep, with the implication that he does not wish to be beholden to the Philistines, But Samson does more than deserve his food. His immense strength generates a significant surplus over and above this. Samson admits as much earlier when he surmises that the Philistines will not punish him past a certain point in order not to endanger the profits he produces for them. It is not merely ironic, then, that Samson enters the temple of Dagon dressed in the state livery of the Philistines. He is both servant and benefactor of the Philistine state. What bothers Manoah and the chorus is that Samson treats his foes as friends, aiding the cause of the Philistine by doing prodigious amounts of milling for them. Once again, Samson loves his enemies, engaging in unintentional, or is it semi-intentional, efforts to do good to those who harm him. Just as his Eros did, Samson's labor crosses enemy lines in a way that both parodies and prefigures Christian charity, limiting the possibility of appalling universalism even in the midst of ongoing war. But again, just as with Eros, Samson's labor resembles charity only to the degree that will allow it to fall conspicuously short of the latter's redemptive ideal. For all that, Samson's milling does manage to invoke a universalism, though not a redemptive one. This is the curse laid upon Adam and Eve following the fall, that they must henceforth earn their bread by the sweat of their brow. The curse of labor is one shared by all of post-lapsarian humanity, uniting them in a condition which is painful, but not in the technical sense of the term tragic. As did Eros, then, labor engages with a pre-covenantal universalism. What binds mankind together is not a redemptive future, but a fallen past, not spirit, but a shared fleshly condition. Sex and labor share more than merely being bodily experiences, moreover. Together, they perpetuate biological existence by conceiving it in the one case and nourishing it in the other. In a sense, they sustain the zone of mere life to which Samson has been condemned in this play, and which, as we have seen, prevents him from rising to the level of the tragic. Universalizing this condition puts tragedy itself in the predicament of Samson, trapped in a realm without access to the ethical and political orders that render tragedy and tragic action meaningful. This is not a case of the death of tragedy, as George Steiner would have it. We should rather say that tragedy, like Samson at the beginning of the play, cannot die. It is itself its sepulcher, persisting in a kind of twilight state that resists a definitive end. I have one more and short section called Samson and Voluntary Servitude. At the risk of descending into cliché, I want to situate Milton's universalism of labor in Samson Agonistes with respect to a later and even more famous statement of this universalism. I am thinking, of course, of the best-known line from the Communist Manifesto, "Workers of the world, unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains." Certainly the curse on Adam and Eve in Genesis hangs heavily in the background of this famous phrase, "The workers of the world, unite," only because this is a world in which most, though not quite all, are condemned to work. I would argue as well that Prometheus, whom Marx pronounced the only saint and martyr in the philosophical calendar, is invoked by the imagery of the chains. Marx's phrase thus conjoins biblical and Promethean traditions in a way striking comparable to what Milton does in Samson Agonisti. In Marx's view, of course, neither Jehovah nor Zeus is responsible for man's laborious condition. Both capital and the state pinion us down, but so too does the twin rule of scarcity and necessity, which in Marx's view can be overthrown only when a certain level of the productive forces is reached under capitalism. Work enchains us insofar as surplus value, absconded with by capitalists, reproduces and expands the repressive apparatus, but that same apparatus, the product of work, also provides the necessary, if merely potential, precondition for freeing workers from their chains. It is worth noting as well that work is not, for Marx, merely the content or characteristic of a universal condition. It is, rather, that which enables a world to be constituted in the first place. A global proletariat can be formed only when a world market has connected the various nations of the planet and slowly eroded both the local traditions and the uneven development that have hitherto separated them. For Marx, as for St. Paul, there is neither Jew nor Greek, but merely a worldwide proletariat on this cusp of transforming their shared condition into a self-consciously united one. To do so, however, will require the leap from production to action, from being a worker to being a doer or agent. While it's true that global capitalism has created the preconditions for revolution in Marx's view, the workers themselves must seize those conditions. Not only the hortatory mode, but the heroic cadences of Marx's statement attempt to provoke the proletariat into action with the aim of creating a world in which both free productive activity and free political action will henceforth be routinely available. The leap from production to action is precisely the one that Milton Samson finds so bedeviling. For Marx to think his way beyond the same dilemma requires formulating a whole new kind of agent or heroic subject, one that is collective rather than individual, a self-conscious social class. This agent not only bears a universalizing mission on its shoulders, but to do so must become aware of itself as a universal. Only thus can its actions achieve a high tragic pitch. Of course, the proletariat does not respond to Marx's clarion call in exactly the way he expects. The apocalyptic fervor of the Communist Manifesto, published in the revolutionary year 1848, thus gives way to the more circumspect views of the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, published in 1852, a work in which the world historical tragedy is always doubled by farce. Samson Agonistes articulates a similar disappointment. After Samson pulls down the Temple of Dagon, thus annihilating the entire leadership of the Philistines, the Hebrews inexplicably fail to seize the moment and instead remain in bondage. Manoah, for one, grasps the liberatory potential of the catastrophe. Quote, to Israel, he says, Israel has Samson has left honor and freedom, let but them find courage to lay hold on this occasion, end quote. But his optative serves merely to remind the reader that Manoah's countrymen will not lay hold on the occasion. Hence the deafening crash of the Philistine temple is ultimately answered by the deafening silence of the Israelites. Moreover, it is this collective silence that retroactively empties out Samson's individual action. If his pulling down of the temple had actually freed his country, it might have risen to the standards of tragedy as Hegel and Kierkegaard understand it. The meaninglessness of the event, its inability to escape from the circularity of the mill, is enforced by the failure of the nation to heed Samson's call. Nor is this the first time they've done so. Early in the play, while recalling one of his victories over the Philistines, Samson bitterly surmises, quote, had Judah that day joined, or one whole tribe, they had by this possessed the towers of Gath and lorded over them who now they serve. But what more oft in nations grown corrupt and by their vices brought to servitude than to love bondage more than liberty, bondage with ease than strenuous liberty, and to despise or envy or suspect whom God hath of his special favor raised as their deliverer. More than anything else, Samson Agonistes is Milton's great meditation on the problem of voluntary servitude, manifested collectively by Israel's relation with the Philistines and individually by Samson's relations with Delilah. What keeps Israel in chains is its unacknowledged collusion with its captors, its choice of easy bondage over strenuous liberty. The concept of ease here is intriguing. Certainly the Israelites don't seem to suffer stark material deprivations as a result of their captivity. While none of them exhibits the sartorial extravagance of a Dalila, they seem to be comfortable enough, and Manoah can even manage to collect the presumably ample funds needed to try to ransom his son. Part of their ease involves adapting to a zone of biological sufficiency that they do not wish to risk losing. But in addition, bondage is its own form of ease, relieving the Israelites of the burden of decision and action, or as Samson puts it, sounding more than a little like Hannah Arendt, strenuous liberty. What Samson diagnoses here is not a mere failure to act, but a positive revulsion towards action as such, the feeling that to be deprived of liberty is preferable to the burden of wielding it. It is one thing to carry the gates of Aza on one's back, as Samson does, or the whole world on one's back, as does Atlas. It's something far more difficult to bear the infinite weight of one's own freedom, if that means not having simply the formal liberty to act, but the obligation and the disciplinary vigor to actually do so. Even Samson chooses to turn the mill endlessly rather than exercise or even recognize the full degree of his liberty. The situation depicted in Samson Agonistes is thus a good deal more complex in some ways than that explored by Aeschylus. Like Prometheus, Samson is in chains. His capacity to act is in that sense physically constrained. But the other Israelites are not. And even Samson comes to recognize that his own brazen shackles are as nothing compared to his mind-forged manacles. It is as if Paul's announcement that there is neither bond nor free now signals not the redemptive cancellation of those two states, but rather the birth of a new terrifying condition that is neither bond nor free, but rather a hopeless confusion of the two. Earlier, I jokingly compared Milton to Hannah Arendt, but I now wish to take the resemblance somewhat more seriously, at least for a moment. What Samson Agonistes shares with Arendt is an apparent sense that labor and action are largely antithetical. Samson's labors not only represent a distinctively sub-tragic form of suffering for Samson himself, they also perpetuate the zone of mere life, which seduces from the hard responsibilities of action. And finally, they infect action with the very quality of labor, so that grinding skulls and grinding grain become indistinguishable. For Marx, by contrast, labor and action are by no means opposed. This is not only because labor creates the material preconditions for revolutionary action, but because the very forms of cooperation required by large-scale capitalist production train the proletariat in working together as a unit and thus prepares them to act collectively. The factory is thus in some sense a rehearsal space for revolution. And yet the leap from production to action still remains. If it did not, Marx would have no reason to utter his stirring call. For Milton, by contrast, the notion of productive labor as an historically progressive force is dimly felt, if at all. Labor is rather the primal curse uttered on humankind, the universality of failure. The leap from labor to meaningful action occurs not across a gap, but across a chasm, paradoxically rendered even wider by the fact that Samson's final action is conceived as just another form of labor, which tends to empty out its meaning. Pessimistic readings of Samson Agonistes have become increasingly common in recent decades, though mine may be darker than most. Certainly Milton had good cause for despair when he composed his play. The collapse of the Commonwealth and the restoration of monarchy, the defeat of the good old cause to which he had devoted his life, and Samson's parlous personal situation have all been much discussed in this context. But economic factors may also play a role. Blair Hauksbee has illuminatingly read Samson Agonistes as a response to, and I'm quoting Hauksbee here, an ideology of productivity that was proving an effective means for Anglican royalists and their allies in the city to counter the iconoclastic rhetoric of their opponents, to consolidate the position of the restored monarchy, and to steer public discourse away from divisive issues of political or church organization toward an ideal of prosperity and productivity that promised to provide a new ground for social consensus, end quote. The challenge posed by post-Restoration prosperity is not just to Milton's particular religious and political beliefs, but to political action as such, which gets displaced by economic production and the goods it provides. It simultaneously poses a challenge to tragic drama, which likewise relies on action in the political or ethical sense for its meaning. In Hauksbee's view, Samson Agonistes is Milton's attempt to resist this productivist ideology and its pacifying effects, quoting him again, by reinscribing desire, tragic conflict, the claims of conscience, and iconoclastic violence into the realm of public discourse, he claims, Milton attempted to prevent the public sphere from being reduced to the world of goods, end quote. I find Hauksbee's reading so impressive that I wish I could believe in its elements of hope. Certainly, the image of a Milton who retains his revolutionary principles, even in the context of what Christopher Hill has called the experience of defeat, is an appealing one. But I find it difficult to see how a tragic protagonist who moves abruptly from a state of paralysis to a spasm of indiscriminate murderous violence can provide a meaningful model of political resistance. At the same time, I don't want to reject Hauksbee's arguments so much as to suggest that by infecting action with the quality of labor, Samson Agonistes takes a deeper and, yes, more pessimistic sounding of the possibilities of action in a novel and alien landscape. The dominant force in this landscape is not the Philistines, Samson's political and religious foes, but rather the mill, to which he is inescapably bound, and which conditions and absorbs everything around it. Resistance to this, whatever form it may take, will look very different from political resistance as classically conceived. In any case, these possibilities cannot even be imagined without first surveying the new landscape in its starkest and most demanding terms. Milton's response to the condition of Restoration society, above all its choice of prosperity over principle, is to fashion a new kind of dramatic agent, a sub-tragic hero, suspended beneath the zone of tragic action and deprived of a universal framework that could render action meaningful. Milton has thereby exposed in an inchoate fashion the dilemma facing modern tragedy. It may be asking a bit much to expect him to resolve that dilemma as well. Thank you.
I was wondering if you would say more about how the difficulty of interpreting the meaning of Samson's final act. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you would say more about how that compares or contrasts with the heroic actions of other tragic heroes. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering I'm just thinking of just a random example and not one that you gave. Like, I think a common debate about Antigone would be, was she right to be so committed to religious values, or should she have? Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering if that...
Right, and there's a certain opacity that hangs about Antigone even beyond her declared motives. And I guess that brings up a larger issue, which I probably should get to, which is that the notion of comprehensibility... and therefore with it the possibility of a connection to an ethical universal, which Hegel imposes on tragedy, could easily be seen not so much as an interpretation of tragedy as a kind of dialectical pacification of it. That is to say, a desire to find a kind of redemptive movement in tragic drama. And in fact, if you think about it, Agamemnon is every bit as opaque and horrifying as Abraham is. So it's not clear, you know what I mean? It seems to me that there's something, this gets at something, I mean, it gets at a fundamental issue with my project, which is something I'm still grappling with, which is this a project about drama, or is it a project about philosophy's response to drama? And is this response... Is the crisis that I'm projecting here a crisis that tragic theater experiences, it, or is it a crisis that people like Hegel and Kierkegaard are experiencing, or even that Aristotle in a different way experiences in the classical era? So what I'd say to that is that, and maybe this is the difference between Samson Agonistes and Antigone, say, is that the desire for a universal framework is explicitly engaged by this play. That is to say, it becomes an explicit desideratum in reading the play, because we're faced with the problem, how can we decide whether Samson is right and Delilah is right if they're doing exactly the same thing, but doing it in different contexts? So I guess what I'd say is that the play itself, and that's a basis of my argument, the play itself insists that we need this universal framework in its own way, which is why I feel comfortable discussing it in kind of an Hegelian frame, you know, an Hegelian framework. So, so that's what I'd say. It itself cries out for universal, which it can't supply for itself, and that to me is part of the interest of its action. But I agree with you, with your premise that Samson's action isn't necessarily a good deal more opaque than that of other tragic heroes and heroines. I think you're exactly right about that.
But I was persuaded that the role of labor in this play made it unique somehow. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's something.
Yeah.
I think there's something really interesting.
Yeah, there. I think it allows him to amplify that meaninglessness. You know, to take a process which is itself doesn't aim at producing meaning, but just producing grain. that allows him to take that conflict to a higher pitch. I think that does do something different. But the basic problems aren't all that different, and I think you're right, and absolutely right in suggesting that.
Thank you.
Sure. Crystal.
I actually have a two-part question that belongs to the divide that you just identified in your own thoughts about your project between philosophy and drama. The one about philosophy is, if, and I love your argument about this poem and the sub-tragic hero, which is a sub-universal hero, right? But what I was confused about along the way was what model of the universal is its sub to? And I'm gonna ask that very particularly. I mean, on the one hand, you seem to be moving towards a Bedouin subtraction, non-Hegelian, I mean, explicitly non-Hegelian model, and a Marxian inversion of Hegel, universal subject kind of model. So that's I just wanted to know what the relationship was between those two. As models of the universal. And then my other question, having to do with drama, is what difference does it make that you chose a closet drama as the centerpiece of your thoughts about drama?
Yeah, okay. That first question, I'll start with the first question because that's a little less like stabbing me in the brain than the second one. But I guess what I'd say is, I go back to one of your premises. I don't see myself as moving towards a Bedouin model or endorsing a Bedouin model of the negative as this. I don't, first of all, I find that book maddening, though brilliant, and wouldn't want to endorse it on various grounds. I find it somewhat disturbing, despite his popularity of late. And it seems to me that this play always sees the failure to achieve the universal as catastrophic. It doesn't have that idea of like being the missing piece that the apparent totality can't account for and will therefore be something. Except that one of the difficulties I find reading it is that the play, and this is part of its kind of, it seems to me, mashing together, and I use that term advisedly, of Hebrew and Greek strains, is that there's this Greek ethical element in it, which leads us to say, well, how can we possibly decide between Dalilah and Samson? And really, they look like exactly like one another, and they just have different nations, and we need to get past those national boundaries. But then, on the other hand, there is this, it seems to me, and Milton holds it quite as clearly, the notion of, this Hebrew notion of Israel as God's unconditionally chosen people, something that has absolutely there's no reason behind it, it cannot be explained, it's simply a pure, free, unconditioned choice, a kind of pure divine sovereignty in a way. And it seems to me that those two codes grate against each other in the play, and that pushing them together like this is meant to, and it causes this kind of weird oscillation between these two kinds of questions. Even if you could decide ethically between Samson and Delilah, or even if you could at an ethical level say, well, there's no ethical difference between them, so that's a plague on both their houses, still there's this other code in the play which is very powerfully felt that doesn't allow you to do that. So I see, so in that sense, I guess, if you wanted to connect Kierkegaard's sort of absolute relation to the absolute, by which the particularity of that of a character withdraws from any kind of ethical universal and simply asserts its absurd or meaningless quality, like that, I suppose, could be reread into a Bedouin framework. But that just gets at what makes me uncomfortable with both Kierkegaard and Bedouin, and which has to do with the absence of serious epistemological issues in either of them, which allows them to assert a kind of militancy, but you can't tell the difference. There's really no way of affirming the difference between a religious lunatic and a genuine prophet in either Kierkegaard or bad Dieu, and I think that's a problem in their work, and it makes me very uncomfortable with it. And I think that also, that's kind of what Milton is getting at in here, you know, when he has these obscure rousing motions, and there's just no way we can tell. There's no evidence provided one way or the other of what they could possibly be. Now, as to your second question, this plagues me, and I don't have a good answer to it. I mean, I think, you know, one of the reasons that I've chosen to focus on tragedy is because it brings real bodies up on stage. You know what I mean? It's an incorporated form of art. And so these problems that I'm talking about, of the merely living and indeed of, you know, and I talk about this in more in my chapter on Aeschylus, but there's a violence involved even in training bodies to become acting bodies that various, you know, in Greece it's much more explicit because it's associated with military exercises and so forth, but it works, you know, it seems to me works in Elizabethan forms as well. So what do I do with the fact that this, you know, thing that this play that I'm taking as somehow emblematic, sort of in a privileged way of the transition I'm talking about, doesn't use bodies and doesn't have any intention of doing so. All I can say is that plagues me deeply. I don't have an answer to that. That really bothers me. If you could think of something on it. I mean, it's something I continue to think about, but I haven't been able. It's a problem for me. You're going to take off on that?
I just wanted to follow up on this point because I had a similar question, which is that I found really interesting, and correct me if I got this point wrong, but I found really interesting your observation that the mill sort of infects the work of Milton's, Samson's mind, and that the functioning of his mind is like drudgery and just sort of repeating the same, almost a fixation. It's so different. I mean, I found your argument convincing, and yet it's so different from the way I'd read the Samson Agonistes, which suggests that there is a kind of intellectual labor that's being performed side by side, and maybe even that's distinguished from the laboring of the day, precisely because it's an idle day, and so therefore there's an allowance for something that's freed from labor going on there.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering if you could speak to that, and maybe as a follow-up to Crystal's question, is it possible that part of what Milton is doing is to try to make the act of reading a bodily action, political action, so that by making it a closet drama, that part of he's doing something with the question of intellectual labor as well.
Right. Okay, a couple things. I guess your question goes to the heart of whether there is a middle to Milton's poem, as Dr. Johnson put it, right? Like whether something significant is happening in all those interviews with, you know, Manoa and Dalila and Harifa. And I've read and I appreciate arguments that argue that some progress is being made and that there's some kind of spiritual journey that Samson is undergoing through each of these encounters. I still feel somewhat skeptical about it. It just seems to me that he holds on to the same old hatreds with Dalila, you know what I mean? That like really hasn't, and he hasn't moved beyond a concept of heroism that goes beyond bodily heroism in relation to Harifa. I mean, I guess I'm more struck by the stubbornness of Samson's mind and its tendency to rehearse old injuries and in exactly the same terms that he always has without making much progress there. So I guess that's just the sense I get of the middle of the play. Though, as I said, I've read arguments that work differently and I also find them impressive, but ultimately to me it's still, the weight of it still falls down on that other side. But in a way, that's just a difference in reading and of two different readers' approach. And I guess I could, you know, the fact that it's a closet drama, I suppose you could connect it to Aristotle's tendency to detach drama from its physical instantiation, which takes various forms, his tendency to downplay elements of a spectacle and to insist that these plays are essentially texts. And there's a very interesting article by a woman. I'm going to get her name wrong. I think it's Helen Foley, but I don't think that's right, called Where's the Polis in Aristotle's Poetics? And basically argues that it's gone. And that's partly because Aristotle wasn't living in Athens at the time that he wrote the Poetics, and there was a kind of life of Greek tragedy which had managed to detach itself in a certain sense from its civic embeddedness in the Athenian polis. But that is itself, you could say, a different way of saying that tragedy no longer has access to that civic life. The techne politikos, the political being that drama is supposed to have. And maybe you could see that as a kind of a counterpart to Samson's, you know, I mean, Samson is in exile and tragedy is in exile in that sense as well. It's not in its embodied world anymore. That's kind of off the cuff, so I don't know if I believe it, but that's what I'll, that's my story and I'm sticking to it. Hi, Colleen.
So I was really taken by your citation of Lucien Vermeer in your talk, and I was wondering, like, something about how you closed your talk today about that figure Samson is suspended beneath tragedy. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, for me, it's important in the 18th Vermeer that it's the lumpen proletariat that Marx is talking about, and that there's a failure there too, for the lumpen is this kind of, they fail to achieve class consciousness, and then, so there's a failed universal, and the problem with the lumpen, right, is that they're more interested in, like, kind of
sausages and champagne.
So it is a significant, and I was wondering if there's a way in which Samson is being read or posed as a kind of lumpen tragic hero
That's interesting.
Or is it that his action, or is it the failed action at the mill that then, where the Israelites are, they fail to be liberated if they're being situated as the lumpen?
Yeah. That's really interesting. I mean, okay, let me say a couple things about that. I really like that formulation. First thing I want to say is, and this is not original with me, but if you look at Joseph Woodruff's books on Samson Agonistes, what he's constantly harping on is the ambivalence of Christian commentators toward Samson, the fact that he's this just kind of, many of them do see him, some see him as a kind of typological prefiguration of Christ, and some see him as this just violent maniac who's the opposite of Christ and therefore is a kind of dangerous model to take. Okay, that's one part of it. The other part, and I didn't really talk about it in this in the talk, is that, you know, the lumpen proletariat for Marx in the 18th Brumaire is in a way the instantiation of the farcical elements that plague the revolution all along. And this gets to something that Milton, you know, an interesting thing that happens in his preface to it, you know, that kind of dramatic heroic poesy, which is called dramatic. He's talking about the kind of play he's going to write. And one of the things he says is, I'm going to restore tragedy from the low opinion into which it's fallen. And that low opinion has resulted from the intermixture of comic elements in with the tragic, and the introduction of what he calls vulgar and trivial persons into the action. And he's clearly thinking of characters like the gravediggers in Hamlet or the porters in Macbeth, who simultaneously introduce both laughter and labor into an otherwise aristocratic milieu. So part of Milton's, I mean, not only does tragedy cathartically purge emotions, but Milton is claiming that he's going to cathartically purge tragedy of these potentially farcical or low comic elements. The problem is that Samson ends up embodying them in certain senses. You know, he ends up, I mean, he's brought in as a kind of common interlude to the Philistines. He said, don't they have wrestlers and, you know, enough and mummers? Why do they need me? And he's trying to say that there's a difference, but he's really saying them the same. And he says, you know, although I am their drudge, I will not be their fool or jester. And yet he uses the word fool of himself, like throughout the drama from beginning to end, which suggests that at another level he's this kind of Shakespearean fool character, the kind of character who would be played by a clown. Now the play doesn't allow you to laugh at him in the same way as, for instance, Shakespeare sometimes allows laughter at King Lear, through the fool in that play, but I do think that there is this unacknowledged, potentially farcical element. And frankly, I mean, Samson himself is a weird figure in Judges, because the other judges are actually like judges, and he's this weird folklore figure who does, you know, who's a prankster, you know, who sets fire to the tails of foxes, and what he does just doesn't have the dignity of the other judges. He's like an old folkloric residue that's somehow been plunked in the middle of that book. And in that way, too, I think he falls beneath, you know, the kind of stature of the character. So yeah, I mean, I think you're getting at something really important there, which is that there is a potentially farcical element in Samson. It's never quite allowed to come to the surface, but it's there, and I think it's really important for thinking about what Milton is doing there, and especially in a play which he claims is going to purge of precisely those elements, and yet stuffs them all into his hero in a very uncomfortable way. So thank you for that observation.
I have a two-pronged question that sort of asks the same question twice. And it's about this great distinction or problematic relationship between labor and action. Mm-hmm. And what you define as the chasm that Samson argues is between labor and action. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if we can think about Samson's final work of labor, mm-hmm. or his final action, whichever, as this inaccessible moment. I mean, the mm-hmm. Milton Stewart seems to go out of his way. Samson has this familiar figure as this overwritten text. Samson Agonistes as the tale so told again. Mm-hmm. When he denies his access not only to the line, the prayer that Samson says, mm-hmm. but even to the spectacle. Mm-hmm. This is a play within a play, mm-hmm. essentially,
yeah.
of a play that we have to imagine ourselves. As Raymond was saying, there's a labor that the reader has to engage in order to even construct the world of Samson. And the play gives us clues about the sounds of people approaching, mm-hmm. and these miscues that seem to hypostatize the stage for us as readers, but mm-hmm. require our mental sort of labor in order to arrive at that final action or that final deed. Mm-hmm. It removes all cues. It's a report. It's something that somebody gives us.
Yeah.
Right? One of the people that witnesses comes and reports it, and they fail to give us that one key mm-hmm. that says God was involved because Samson prayed. Necessarily, it makes it, and I want to see if I can call it surplus, mm-hmm. because it's also like the rousing motions that go on within Samson. Mm-hmm. We don't have access to them. We don't know whether this is actually the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
We just don't know. Mm-hmm. And this just, I want to see if this enacts the chasm, and so there's this uncertainty. But we don't know. We can't, and we have to decide in our labor mm-hmm. whether we're going to see Samson as mm-hmm. transcending his own toil. Mm-hmm. Or whether he's actually continuing. And the other prong of the question is relates to how Samson sees himself at the start of the play of the drama as he says something like designed for God's prophet, mm-hmm. God's instrument, but made to toil in raising chains.
Yeah.
He sees himself actually as an instrument already of somebody else. There's no he's laboring, and his labor provides the surplus to God now. And over the course, and his God is the God of the Old Testament, the God of the written word. And so at first, when he resists going to perform, he says it's against the laws of my nation and my religion to do this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then some rousing motions occur that we don't have access to, and he changes his mind. Mm-hmm. And so it seems like a different kind of decision, mm-hmm. literally opposed to the decision he made earlier to send the messenger away. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if I mean, I still see this chasm, but whether it's literally a matter of faith or of being the reader ceding to a spirit or something, some mm-hmm. rousing motions that allow us to mm-hmm. push Samson past the tragic into tragic, or reduce him to farce.
That's nice. I guess what I'd say is that there's the play dangles maddeningly the possibility that leap into faith is just a mistake. You know what I mean? There is no... And of course, with a leap of faith, that would always have to be present, because if it weren't present, then you would know where you were going, and there would be no leap of faith. But it seems to me that it gets at the difficulty of that moment. And to simply say, that the reader has to make that decision, in a sense, to me, doesn't get us anywhere past the problem of Samson himself. That is, just as it's obscure, just as there's no textual evidence to let us know what the source of Samson's decision is, so the reader who makes a leap of faith doesn't really have anything to go on either, and that faith may be properly placed or misplaced. So I'm not sure. I see what you're saying, and I think that's true. And he's raising larger issues, obviously, of scriptural interpretation and its relation to various forms of inspiration, but it seems to me he produces a very pessimistic version of that endeavor of interpretation and interpretation of the scriptural story. It just seems to me it dead ends in a way such that, you know, if your act of interpretation and faith is mirrored in Samson's act, that's not a very encouraging model, it doesn't seem to me, for that. And so it should give us pause, I think, about what's going on there. Yes? Yes?
I wonder if I could put your talk into dialogue with your recent Hamlet article on Hamlet and the political economy.
Mm-hmm.
And this might get at some of the questions that have been asked today, like about surplus and production, mm-hmm. and lumpen tragicness,
okay.
And also maybe about this issue of closet drama as well.
Mm-hmm.
So in that article, you talk about this tradition of thinking about, well, there's so labor, mm-hmm. on the one hand, that sort of produces nothing,
right.
Like that, sort of like the labor that a servant does, mm-hmm. that sort of ephemeral or sort of vanishes.
Service economy labor,
right.
Yeah, that sort of disappears at the moment of it.
But then there's also this work that, mm-hmm. that makes something that can be used later.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess so one question is, so what does Samson do? Is he laboring or working?
Mm-hmm.
And does it matter that he makes something that people can eat? You know, this sort of...
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it's true that the mill is all about this apocalyptic repetition,
yeah.
and sort of it's a cycle that aren't really making
mm-hmm.
anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of drudging away.
Right.
But then again, it's producing a real commodity that has
yeah.
value,
yeah.
that can be consumed
mm-hmm.
and eaten,
mm-hmm.
If not by Samson himself,
yeah.
By others, or right? So that's one thing. But on the other hand, I think it's also, because it's a closet drama, and thinking about, once again, the Hamlet article, this whole poem might have a different relationship to work and labor.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking about this moment in the Hamlet article when we talk about flesh and bone, and the idea
mm-hmm.
of flesh as sort of the performance that vanishes
mm-hmm.
as it's done,
right.
but the text that remains as the bone that is tangible
mm-hmm.
and that we can
mm-hmm.
grasp.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe something about it being a closet drama has some sort of...
Yeah.
interconnection here is kind of always just a bone.
Mm-hmm.
There's no flesh to ever worry about.
Yeah.
And this is going to be really, I mean, out of field, but there's like this bone in Samson. And this, I mean, you know, Samson, the whole story of Samson, this
jawbone.
Mule bone, right. That
mm-hmm.
he uses, I mean, I don't know if that makes any, if that's productive, but
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
there is a bone.
Yeah. There is a bone, exactly.
And aside from that,
yeah.
which is possibly random, at least I think that maybe thinking of the boneness of this closet drama versus
mm-hmm.
the flesh and boneness of
yeah.
Hamlet or any other stage drama might be productive or interesting, and then thinking about labor versus
mm-hmm.
work in general and
yeah.
commodity consumption.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's okay, there's a lot there. Let me go to the bone for a minute and start with that, then go to the... You know, one of the things I didn't discuss, and it seems to me it problematizes things. I've been, you know, in my association of Samson with a kind of Promethean technical arts, metallurgy, you know, all those things, and associating him with labor in that sense, there's a complication in the play which I didn't mention, which is that in his confrontation with Harapha has this, like, fantastic armor, right? And it's all very beautiful, and it's beautifully made, and Samson very pointedly won't use that. I mean, he's very pre-technological in the play, you know what I mean? The only thing he'll use is a bone that he finds on the ground, but not those things that would be produced by human labor too. And so there's a way in which, and it seems to me, there are complicated things going on here, and to go on a little bit more, the whole question of Prometheus and the Titans is a complicated one, because, for instance, there was an edition of Prometheus Bound that was produced by Thomas Stanley in 1633, in which he makes explicit parallels between Prometheus and Christ. And he says, basically, just as Prometheus suffered in order to do mankind good, so Christ did that as well. And yet, at the same time, he's aware of him as a kind of titanic rebel against the justice of the Olympian order. So it kind of falls in that. And my sense is that Milton uses Harrifa, in a sense, to carry off that titanic metallurgical, you know, implication, to sort of cleanse Samson of it in a way, while still associating him in other ways with certain other aspects of Prometheus. So that's the small answer to your question. The grain, I mean, you know, so we have to go to Arendt here, right? And it'll bring us back to Adam Smith as well. Because Arendt, yes, he's producing something, but the good he's producing is a consumer good that will disappear instantly. And this is what Arendt, this is how she distinguishes between labor and work. Labor is that which makes commodities which are instantly consumed disappear, and therefore merely enable the reproduction of the ongoing cycle of life and death, which is our, you know, sort of natural inheritance, whereas work makes those things that last, like a piece of armor, for instance, that allow a kind of artificial world to be created, which is a distinctively human world. So what Samson does is labor in that sense. He's making this grain which will be baked into bread or whatever and immediately disappear. Okay, that connects him with characters like the grave diggers in Shakespeare's play, who also do, like, they dig holes. You know, they don't make anything, they don't grow anything. It's a service economy, actually, a service economy for the dead. But it's exactly that, what Smith would refer to as a sort of disappearing work of the servant. And by the way, Smith himself makes distinctions between ephemeral and lasting commodities that Arendt kind of overlooks in order to paint him with a certain brush, so I should say that. So yeah, I mean, I think that he does fit into that same kind of economy of labor rather than an economy of work that you find in Shakespeare. And I should also say, just to connect those a little bit more, that, and this is something I'm trying to work out, when I talk about Samson's mill-like activity of mind, the way his mind becomes captured by the activity of the mill, there's a real parallel there to the way in which I talk about the churning of Hamlet's thoughts as they circle around the same thing, which for me subsequently was like interestingly illuminated by a fact that I didn't know when I wrote that article, which is, if you go back to the deepest sources of Hamlet before Belforest and before Saxo Grammaticus and the original Norse saga in which he appears, he has a mill. Hamlet has a mill. And in fact, there was a terrible comparative mythology book written in the early 70s called Hamlet's Mill. And so there is this kind of weird, deep connection, I think, between Hamlet, that, you know, that Hamlet's mental motions are also the motions of the mill, just as Samson's are. And there are certain things that connect those plays, I think, rather profoundly along those lines.
So. I suggest you continue the conversation with Richard upstairs in the English Lounge, Bellfire Lounge on the second floor, and please join me in thanking Richard for his time.
Thank you. Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.